Hi, welcome to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick and my co-host is Chris Lucian. And today we are very excited to have Alan Holub on the show and got a lot of fun, exciting things to discuss. You know, we might hit agility versus agile, mob programming, team communication, limiting management, all sorts of fun things. So we'll see where it goes though. I guess to get us started, Alan, can you share a little bit about yourself and how you came to know about mobbing?
Two very different questions. I've been doing this forever, right? Is that I've been doing agile stuff almost since agile stuff has existed, at least as far as I knew about it. So say since about 2000 plus or minus. And before that, I of course was doing programming, right? As I started out as doing hardware, in fact, as a robotics engineer, and we were working with chips that didn't have a lot of software support. It was old, you know, Motorola controller chips and stuff, and there were no compilers, so I had to learn how to write a compiler. And then there was no operating system, so I had to learn how to write an operating system. And by the time that was all done, I was not a hardware engineer anymore. I was a programmer. So, yeah, you know, and I wrote for Dr. Dobbs for years. I wrote for Java World, a bunch of books. Right now, I'm doing mostly Agile-related consulting, a lot of training, a lot of sort of agility work with executives and the companies. I'll come in and kind of look around and assess how people are doing and then help them try and move forward a little bit with that. I put it in terms of agility rather than agile because agile has come to be an evil word. You know, Andy Hunt said it pretty well. He said agile has come to mean do half of Scrum badly and use Jira, and I kind of agree with that. Right? Is that it's the word has been perverted to the point where it doesn't have any value anymore. So, I've been doing a lot of that, and I've been doing a lot of training. I'm putting together I have put together and are presenting like a general agility class and a technical agile class that includes a lot of mobbing and things like that. You know, sort of general agile stuff. Many hats. I used to speak at a lot of conferences while there were still conferences. Yeah. Hopefully there will be conferences again next year. At least they're starting to schedule next year, is that everybody's being optimistic. So we'll see how that goes. But here we are.
Yeah, so thanks for sharing a little bit about your journey there. When did you start encountering mobbing in your world?
Oh, gosh. It was pretty soon after Woody introduced it, is that the and Woody and I know each other now, is that back when he first came up with mobbing, we didn't. But I was kind of on top of it on Twitter, certainly, as soon as he started talking about it.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I had always been a big fan of collaborative work. So the idea seemed just intuitively right to me the first time I heard about it. And I tried it the next time I did a class, and it worked so well that I haven't used anything else since then. Every time I teach workshop kind of class, right? TDD or something like that. It's always mobbing, is that I won't do anything else anymore. So, and every time I touch a company, I try and bring mobbing in with greater or lesser success, depending on the company. But the, you know, there's all the stuff that I'm sure you guys have encountered about introducing the whole mobbing thing, right? That's, it's always an issue that people are always dubious up front, right? They don't want to have anything to do with it. And I go, oh, let's just try it for a week. And usually by the end of the week, people don't want to do anything else. Yeah. But there's always holdouts, right? There's always people who are saying, I'm never going to do this again. I just want to like crawl into a cave and throw meat at me once a week and I'll be happy. Yeah. Those guys are doomed, right? Is that the software profession is changing. It's becoming much more social. Yeah. Those guys that are just, I don't even want to use the word introvert, is we're going on the level of sociopath here. It's not going to work, right? Is that model for programmers is not going to work anymore, I don't think.
Can I suggest the diffusion of innovation theory, the laggard concept might be.
The laggard, right? Definitely laggard.
Yeah, although laggard is not quite a nice word either. But
It'd be nice if there was a politically correct way to say it, but they resist for reasons that I find kind of baffling. They're sort of holding on to the old way of doing things. And then there's always, of course, the for some reason, groups always want to, they say, this mobbing stuff is great. We're going to use it where it's appropriate.
Yeah.
And I go, well, what does that mean? And they say, well, I'll use it for this and we'll use it for that. And it's like, there's this kind of arc that companies kind of go through where they start with that, use it when it's appropriate. And then they say, okay, so let's do our code review now for all the stuff that we wrote when we weren't mobbing. And I say, so let's get together as a mob and do that. Yeah. And they all get together as a mob. And at some point they always say, you know, if we had been mobbing when we were writing this code, we wouldn't have to be doing these code reviews. Yeah. And eventually they kind of move off into mobbing all the time.
I really like that concept. It's kind of like a, experience what can be good and then go in and experience the pain and then experience it together and then realize like, oh, hey, we didn't need to do this in the first place.
Let's and it's just about everybody is sold on it. And it's working pretty well remotely. I have mixed feelings about remote work in general. I'm not a big fan of it. But I understand the necessity of doing it. Mm-hmm. And my general feeling about remote is that there's always a hit. There's always a penalty. So it's a straight business decision. Are you willing to pay for it or not? Right. If the people who live in fantasy land are the people who say, oh, we're going to go remote and save money. And that's not true. Right. you lose productivity and you lose a bunch of things. Right. And they don't want to ever pay for the infrastructure that they need for remote. They won't pay for a dedicated high speed internet connection into every employee's house, for example.
Yeah.
So a lot of the cost gets put under the shoulders of the employees, which I don't think of as a particularly good thing. Mm-hmm. And but there's always a cost, usually in productivity hit of one sort or another. And if there's a good reason for it, and certainly staying alive is a good reason, who could argue with that? But people like the convenience of being able to work remotely sometimes, and for some people that's good. But I think it's always best if you work together. And I particularly see that mobbing, because mobbing works really well with Zoom, but it works even better when everybody's in the same room. There's just all the visual cues and stuff that you get when you're in the same room with somebody just go away when you're mobbing remotely with little postage stamp pictures of people on the screen. So, it's working out okay, but it's not great. Part of it is that none of the software that we're using is designed to do what we do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Zoom kind of works, but it's not ideal.
Yeah. We have kind of a cocktail of different softwares that put everything together.
Yeah,
that's kind of how you get there, right?
So I have to have Zoom running with the mob on it, and then Miro running on iPad with the whiteboard on it, and somehow get this code up there so that everybody can look at it, and it's just kind of a mess. And it'd be nice if there was an integrated platform that actually did it well, but I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing the same thing with schools too, right? Is all the business about people not wanting to go back to school.
Yeah.
And which is also sensible to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not in favor of killing children, but but there isn't any good software for doing teaching remotely. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Teaching using Zoom and bungling stuff together and stuff, but yeah. I can't, there's no way that I can duplicate come even close to duplicating the experience of everybody in one room and then breaking up into groups and then coming back together and all the cross fertilization that happens between groups and stuff. It just doesn't happen remotely, and there's no good software for doing it. So I have a lot of sympathy for the school teachers out there that are trying to be effective in a remote world where there is no software that's designed to teach.
Well, I think that'll become that's a really interesting point, because everybody in the world is new at it, right? And they're all new at it at the same time. And so I guarantee that there are many systems in development now. And depending on how long this goes on, right, there's the possibility that these things are very developed.
We'll see. I don't know. I haven't, whether there's something in development for that specific problem, I don't know.
Yeah, sure.
And you look at the existing players right now and they seem uninterested.
Yeah.
And there's one platform that I know that's reasonably good for teaching, but they've got this insanely expensive sales model.
Yeah.
So normal human beings can't afford it.
Well, when the competition increases, then it starts to democratize the systems, right? And so there's a lot of software out there that's insanely expensive. And as soon as a competitor comes out with some disruptive model, a business model, then everybody folds really quickly. And so, that in the end could become a result of this, is that two or three more competitors enter the market and all of a sudden the cost of remote.
It's working. That'd be good.
Right now,
no.
Right?
Yeah. This is going to be a larger remote component, obviously, even when we start working together again. So we need it.
Yeah.
And there's Jitsi too, which is, it's open source. It's not great. It's an open source project, right? Its quality is not great, but it's there and it's free, and somebody can grab onto that and make it better, turn it into something that's polished and sort of more workable than it is.
Yeah, and I think so. It's pretty interesting. So I came into, I guess I'll share my story, which is just one story with it. But the I remember you asking me, Chris, I think it was about 9 months ago. You were like, do you think if remote mobbing would work good as in person? And I said, no, you know, but I hadn't tried it. And then I was, one person in my mob right now, he, before we had to remote mob because of COVID, he told me like, yeah, I remote mob on the weekend with my friends. It works great. It's just like being in person. And I was like, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. But then when we all forced to do it, I think there's this, I don't know, it's maybe like some sort of satire change curve or something like that, that we hit where the cocktail Chris was talking about. Like we have this tool for this and this tool for this and this tool for this. And if you do mobbing full time, you kind of find the perfect blended cocktail that, yeah, where, you know, hits all the notes we need it to hit. And then I have to say, I've been persuaded that it's just as good. But I might be in a strange bubble that has had everything work itself out, so that the tools and the drawing and the interactions and my mob always has their cameras on and all those kind of things. And so, and then Chris has an incredible setup for the different mobs and how they can interact with each other and cross pollinate. And so I could see if you've only tried it for a little bit remote, it's probably can be pretty terrible, I think, if you have the wrong cocktail.
It could be. But even then, you know, teaching this stuff, people pick up on it pretty quickly, even remote. They like it. You know, but of course they're working remote now, not mobbing.
Yeah.
So the transition is not that extreme, right? It's from remote working by yourself to remote mobs.
Probably they're desperate for human interaction.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Like, they're programming by themselves. Mobbing sounds great, right? Like, I just want to talk to somebody, please.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this might be a good time to transition topics. You mentioned it earlier, agility versus agile. Do you mind explaining that a little bit more?
That's more and more a big deal for me, particularly when I'm doing consulting work, is that, you know, agile has turned into this awful thing. It's come to mean these horrible rote processes that are forced down people's throats by the companies that they work for, and the you know, Scrum. You see a lot of Scrum shops I go into, it's like Scrum was forced on everybody to the point where everybody literally marches in lockstep, is that they all start their sprints on Wednesday morning and they all have, you know, the whole company, right? 500 people, and they're all like marching in lockstep doing this crazy, not very good Scrum implementation. And if agile is good, and it's safe, of course, is the work of the devil. It's just an abomination. It's complete snake oil. And the snake doesn't do a damn thing. There's no agility there at all, right? So it's just another big corporate process that people can use in order to check off the agile box. And it's got no, you know, it's the Safe Consultants Full-Time Employment Act. But other than that, it has no, it's not going to help any of these organizations, really. It's a perfectly good process. It's just an agile one. And so since agile has come to mean that, I'm trying to get away from that word. And what we're actually trying for is agility, right? Yeah. Not agile, but agility. Because if agile means do Scrum, I'm not interested in that. It's kind of boring and it doesn't work very well. Sure. I want to get more agility in the organization. I want the organization to be more able to get something valuable into its customers' hands quickly. Mm-hmm. And to be able to change what they're doing as needed based on feedback that they're getting. You know, all of these things that go into actually being agile with a lowercase a. Mm-hmm. So my approach now, even when I'm consulting, it has nothing to do with agile. I don't say I'm going to make you agile. And I won't buy the whole agile transformation garbage at all. Is that what I do is I sit down with the people I'm going to work with and I say, tell me what you worry about. What are the business problems that you're having? And then I'll say, and then give me a week or so and I'll sit down and I'll kind of just observe. I'll look at everything. I'll see how you work and I'll see how things flow through the organization and see what's kind of getting in the way of you getting those business problems solved. And then the two of us will sit down and we'll come up with some strategy for putting some new things in place that will solve the problems. And those, of course, are agile and lean things because that's what I know, but I don't need to bring up the word. Right, the dreaded A word is like, so let's try this, right? Let's try that. And since we're doing it in an agile, incremental kind of way, you can set a metric, not a metric necessarily, but some indicator that you're making progress. And you can say, so let's try this. And let's see if we can move that indicator, whatever it is, you know, be it a metric or be it just happiness, right? Or some some sort of very loose kind of thing. So if the metric's moving, then the people I'm working for are happy. Yeah. And nobody in the world, I think, who understands anything, even in a rudimentary way, wants to be agile, right? I don't even know what that means, to be agile. We're going to be agile, right? It's, what does that mean? Is that what they want to do is solve business problems. They want to be more effective. Yeah. So the idea of business agility becomes very important there. So what we're trying to do then is have as much agility as possible inside the organization, however we're going to do that. And I don't want to talk about sprints and backlogs and stand-up meetings and all that garbage. I want to just say, okay, what do we do to get more agility into this system? So understand the system and let's get more agility into it.
Whenever I meet a new developer, usually the conversation goes, oh, you know, so do you, or like, you know, we do agile practices, right? And then they're like, oh, you do Scrum. It's like, no, well, and so I've used terms like Zanpan or, you know, just Bob programming. It's like more descriptive and direct. So it's an interesting thing to just say, you know, we try and achieve more agility in our work.
Yeah, more agility. That's the goal here is agility and effectiveness and things like that. Agile is not, it doesn't seem worthwhile to me to try and be agile. I don't even, especially since I don't know what the word means anymore.
Yeah.
And so many people seem to think that it means bizarre things that are the opposite of what the word actually means.
Yeah.
I don't remember who said it. Somebody on Twitter the other day said something the effect that the if you're using the word agile, you're not. Yeah, right. Yeah. Is that the, and I agree with that, right? It's that let's just do stuff that works. Let's try and make things better.
Yeah. And you know, there's definitely systems out there that are descriptive, right? Like, you know, agile kind of ended up being this blanket word and then was taken over by, you know, certifications and things like that, which I think is what you're getting at.
Well, the certification stuff is really awful.
Yeah.
That's gotten so far away from agility that it doesn't even count it's lowercase agile anymore.
Yeah. It's become a business term or a business buzzword. And
well, it's a rigid thing. You're getting certified by knowing something. You can take a test in it, right? So whatever that test is testing, that's what the thing is.
Yeah.
And well, it's a rigid thing. You deviate from that and you'll fail the test. You deviate from that and you're not doing the thing. Well, you can't be rigid and agile at the same time. It's not possible.
Yeah.
So if you've got a rigid framework of any sort, then it can't possibly be agile. There's no way. So, you know, and that's all of them. I'm an equal opportunity hater here, right? It's not just Scrum, right? It's Scrum and Safe and Kanban and all of them. Is that the approach has to be flexible or it's not agile.
Yeah.
And, you know, and ultimately it comes down to values and principles and sort of understanding how things work, is theory of constraints and lean theory and agile theory and all of that kind of stuff. And then blending it together in a way that makes sense in context.
There's a lot of these like anti-frameworks coming out as frameworks now too, where it's
those
like,
are frameworks too,
you know, mix and match. yeah. So
but those are just as much less, right? Less is just as much a framework as anything else. You know, it's better than most because it is trying to be less, but still, you can't just keep taking stuff away and saying it's better because we're taking stuff away.
If you look at a
complicated value stream.
Right.
There's a lot there. And there's a lot you need to know to make sense of it. Is that all of this lean stuff and all the stuff about product development flow and theory of constraints and bottlenecks and all of that all counts. It all matters. Mm-hmm. Right. And you start taking stuff away in order to simplify and you can simplify to the point where it becomes simplistic, in which case it stops working.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, so tool vendors and certificate vendors, they constantly are chasing that. Right. So they want the next buzzword to be the only thing that, or they want to be the only place where you can be trained in the next buzzword, right? And so it's an infinite cycle because everybody that wants to think about just principles and theories will name it something, right? And then those people will then chase it and make a product about it, and then those people will move away, right? And so it's hard to say that it will ever come to an end, right?
Well, it's carny stuff, right? They're selling snake oil.
Yeah.
And you go to a carnival and somebody's selling snake oil and they'll sell it until people stop buying it.
Yeah.
And there's always morons in the crowd that are going to buy it. I don't want to call people who are using Scrum morons, because that's not true. They believe that they're doing something useful. But I think that the whole certification thing is just fundamentally cynical and dishonest. I don't buy it. I don't think anybody that's selling those things actually believes what they're selling is going to save the world. I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that, you know, on some level, a lot of it is just kind of like a gateway practice, right? Like, people that don't know where to start at all.
I don't buy that at all. And we can discuss that, yeah, right? Because the people always bring that up with Scrum. It's like, oh, it's training wheels. And my response to that is that nobody on the planet has ever learned to ride a bike by putting training wheels on it. You don't learn to ride a bicycle until you take the training wheels off.
Yeah, sure.
But the training wheels, if anything, prevent you from learning how to ride the bicycle.
Yeah.
Right? And Scrum prevents you from being agile.
Yeah.
And if you do Scrum for a long time, you're going to develop all these bad habits that are going to prevent you from being agile. And you're going to develop all of these ideas about the way things are supposed to work, which are not correct, at least not correct in your context. Yeah. And they prevent you from being agile. So I don't buy that training wheel thing.
I would rather
incrementally introduce stuff that makes sense in context in order to fix problems.
Well, I think what it is that it's people don't know where to go, right? Like, if you're in an organization that is inherently non-agile trying to become agile, right? And they're only trying to become agile because they've been told to become agile, then those are the people, those are the targets, right? Like, they're the ones that are being sold to because they don't know any better and they're trying to do the right thing. And, but often, you know, if somebody brings in somebody that is offering something that is not the cliche version of agile, then those people won't have a safe environment. They'll get beat down because they didn't go and find the Scrum vendor, right? And so there's a systematic, you know, reinforcement of the current system, right? And I think it's going to be really people that are actually looking into the reality of things and doing enough research about it to find out that there's different flavors of things and you know, incrementally building up self-organizing.
Yeah. Well, it takes the people on the top of the hierarchy have to do their homework.
Yeah.
And if they're not willing to do that, they're not going to succeed. And that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. You know, there is a chicken and egg problem. If you don't know anything, how do you know who to trust?
Yeah.
Right. Well, so the getting started is a problem.
Yeah.
And the problem with the big corporations is the people they trust are the people they play golf with, who are just as clueless as they are.
That's pretty much what I was going to say.
You know, the other problem is that the best agile consultants on the planet are all independents.
Yeah.
Right. It's very few really good agile shops are company-like things, right? Josh Karofsky's Industrial Logic is probably the only legitimately agile company that I know of that's more than just one person working alone.
Yeah.
And the corporate mentality is that if it's not, you know, a big three consultancy, they're not legitimate.
Yeah.
So they hire these idiots that don't have a clue what they're talking about in order to give them bad advice because they're big three consultancies or whatever, right? They're big companies. And they don't even consider hiring the people that are the best people. Often, some of whom are the signatories in the Agile Manifesto, right? A lot of the people that signed the manifesto are still working as consultants. And, you know, sometimes they get work, sometimes they don't. And it's because the people running the corporations kind of don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, the other problem, of course, is that it's very actual agility is very threatening to somebody who's running a big command control corporation.
Yes.
They don't want to give up the control.
Well, and that's a big thing to say about safety in general, right? Like, if you can't have a safe environment, then you're almost predisposed to being forced into one of these systems that when you're trying to be agile. And so what ends up happening is you have that command and control environment and you want everything done the right way, quote unquote. And so it cascades into a series of decisions that are based off of fear. And, you know, I really don't like the fear-based decision-making. It's a self-reinforcing loop. And I think a lot of it has to do with safety, right? Because it's likely that somebody on the ground level would have picked the right person to come in and train them. But a lot of the times what they're looking at is some of these like higher end publications that get kickbacks from these consultancies as part of advertising fees. And then they get lured into forcing that thing onto
the. Well, and they don't see the internal paradox there, sure. Right? In that it's safety, but it's also trust, right? And so you have somebody and you trust them to write the software, where if they fail writing the software properly, the company is just going to go belly up.
Yeah.
Right? Is that the company's continued existence depends on these people being able to do their job, but you don't trust them to do anything else. You don't trust them to buy pencils. You don't trust them to pick training that they need. You don't trust them to go on a necessary business trip to a conference if there's conferences ever again, you know? So it's kind of this odd clash between trusting somebody and not trusting somebody at the same time. And the agility, of course, is all about speed. Mm-hmm. And if you can't let the people who are doing the work make the decisions, you lose all the speed.
Yeah.
So you can't be agile if you have like a so-called Chrysler model, right, with a hierarchy and all reports go up the hierarchy and then somebody makes a decision and the decision goes down, right? That's the opposite of agile because, well, first of all, the information gets screwed up as it makes that loop. And secondly, by the time you get all the way up and all the way back down again, the situation on the ground has changed and whatever decision you made was the wrong decision for the current context. And you can't respond fast enough.
Yeah.
And the only way around that is to trust people. Mm-hmm. To say, okay, you're building the software. You go talk to the customers. When they tell you something, fix it. Don't get permission. Just fix it. Right. And the it's very, very difficult for some organizations to go there. And the larger it is, the harder it is.
Yeah.
Well, so the whole safe market, right? The big corporations and safe and stuff, those guys are never going to be agile. You know, so in a way, I don't care about them because I've given up on them, right? Yeah. They're hopeless, right? They're not agile now. They're not even close. They never will be agile because they just don't get it on a fundamental level.
Yeah.
And it's a pity, but there's nothing that I can do about it. There's nothing anybody can do about it. So I get a lot of stuff on Twitter about people are saying, oh my God, but in my world, in the real world, we can't do X. And I'm going, well, so you're saying you can't be agile. So I live with that. Is that you can't have it both ways, right? A bunch of stuff today about contracts, right? About, well, we can't get this contract because the customer demands that we have a upfront plan and schedules and milestones and we deliver exactly what we said we were going to deliver up front. And I'm going, well, you can't, that's waterfall. You can do that, right? You can't be waterfall and agile at the same time. That's not possible. So if your clients are demanding that, the only choice you have is to be a waterfall organization. And if you want to be an agile organization, you have to find a different set of clients, or at least educate the clients you have so that they'll accept working in an agile way. Is that you can't have a better way to say this is that the contract that you have always specifies the way you're going to work. Mm-hmm. It's built into the contract. Is that if what a contract is it's saying you are going to work in this way in order to do that.
Yeah.
And so you can't take a contract that's saying you're going to work in a waterfall way and then try and work in an agile way because you'll be in breach of contract.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The contract has to describe an agile way of working. It can't describe a waterfall way of working. So here these guys are saying, well, in the real world, we have to have these waterfall contracts. And I'm going, so in your real world, you can't be agile. Just live with it. Right. Or find different clients.
For the benefit of the listeners, what would be some of the buzzwords that you would be behind? Like I heard you say lean practices and self-organizing and things like that. Like what are the things that haven't been tainted in your mind?
That haven't been tainted?
Yeah.
You know, the individual practices, sure, for the most part, have not been tainted.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you start talking about TDD or story maps or stories is a hard one because people don't understand what they are, but that's a solvable problem. That's an education problem. The thing, you get into theories and the theory of constraints and you can talk about product development flow and that kind of stuff. Right? None of that's been tainted. It is what it is and it's a piece. Yeah. But it's a piece that people can understand,
yeah,
right? As you can get your head, it's not a big system that you have to keep in your head all at once. It's a little piece. Yeah. What people have a hard time with is figuring out how to put those pieces together, mm-hmm, right, in a way that makes for a coherent large system, right? And it's the large system that counts, right? If we're gonna make an organization work better, what we have to do is change the overall system, right? Not the pieces.
Yeah.
You can try and change pieces one at a time, and sometimes that can change the overall system, provided that the people at the top of the hierarchy really know what the hell they're doing and are willing to allow it to change. Really going to help.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very few companies that have pulled that off. There are a few big companies that have become much more agile over time. Yeah. Home Depot comes to mind, Mahoner Irrigation, obviously, a few others, right? But they're the exception, they're not the rule. Mm-hmm. And what it took, and every one of those companies that I've had anything to do with, at least, it's the people that are on top who are driving it. And they did a lot of homework up front and really understood what the issues were, and yeah. then did it properly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes that was incremental. More often than not, it was not. It was just a big bang transition.
Yeah.
That a lot of, I think about what ING Bank in Australia, and or New Zealand rather. And the ING is in Holland. I'm what am I thinking of? ANZ, right? The Australian New Zealand Bank. But they tried three times before they got it right.
Yeah.
You know, and they tried to do incremental this and incremental that, and it didn't work. And finally, they said, "Just the hell with this. We're going to do a big bang transition. And if you don't like it, leave."
Yeah.
And that worked, right? So, but you can't pull that off unless you're willing to put up with the disruption, unless you've got people who really understand where they're headed and what's going to work and what's not going to work and that kind of stuff at the top, and are willing to put up with flack, right? Those guys had to deal a lot with regulators who were saying, well, you know, you can't just fire people because you're changing the way you're working. And I'm going, and they're going, well, we have nothing for them to do anymore.
Yeah.
We're happy to train them. We're happy to keep them, right? But they can't keep their current job because their current job does not exist anymore inside the company, right? What do you do with that, right? Middle managers. What do you do with middle managers when you go agile? Is that they have nothing to do, right? If the team is managing itself, what does a line manager do? Right. And other than cause trouble, they don't do anything. Is they're the opposite of dead weight? Is they're actually pulling you back, pulling you down? So other than a huge crash, whatever.
Are that okay, right?
Yeah, we're fine. It was probably a dog. Right. But so other than retraining, what do you hear them in? Bentley, come here. I don't know what the dog did, but I didn't want to mess him with it. Good boy. So other than retraining them, there's not much you can do. And a lot of them, their sense of self-worth is tied up in the job that they do and the way they do it, right? A good manager, that's a skill that takes a long time to develop, right? And good managers are problem solvers, and good managers are, they know how to work the system in order to get what they want, and they're masters of politics and all this other stuff that shouldn't be happening in an agile organization. So the skills that they have so carefully developed over years don't really have much value anymore in this new context.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying the skills aren't valuable, they're just not valuable in that context. And a lot of people would say, well, you know, I like what I'm doing, I don't want to do this new thing, and that's fine, I have no problem with that. But to imagine that you can keep them there and put this layer of scrum on top of the organization, right? Every team still has a project manager. Oh, by the way, we're not doing projects anymore, and the team is managing its own work. And you go down the list and you go, so what's left for this project manager to do? And there's nothing left. But they're still there, right? So they twiddle their thumbs and they say, I can't just play canasta all day. I've got to figure out something useful to do with my time. And then they start causing trouble because anything that they can do, everything they can do hurts. And, you know, it just, it wrecks things. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just been very fascinating to hear your experiences on this. And I mean, I might have a more rosy colored sunglasses view of things. Cause I used to be, I used to be some of these people, right? Yeah, I came into it going through the certification system, being at a full-time scrum shop. And from my experiences, and maybe this is just because it's hard to speak for everybody, right? But from my experiences, I just didn't know what I didn't know, right? And so I thought, you know, hey, I'm at a place we're doing waterfall. There's a lot of inefficiencies and a lot of waste going on. What's another thing to try instead? And then scrum. Scrum. Was the
Freud speaks.
Scrum was within reach, and I did certifications through it. And there seemed to be some great teachers there who taught me a lot of great agility, I feel like, but it was through the framework. And it wasn't until later, and I think it was one of Karievsky's talks where he said, like, hey, you don't need the training wheels, you know what I mean? And then he started talking about people who are mob programming and doing other things, and I'm like, oh yeah, you're right, there is all this waste in the system. Yeah. Still, it's better than it was before, but there's all this other waste. And so then it led me to try other experiments. And so
how big was the company you were working with when you were doing that?
The software shop was not huge. It's probably like 30, 40 people.
Yeah. See, that size is easy.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. That size is easy because everybody, you know, 30 people, that's way below Dunbar's number, right? Is that you can self-organize.
Yeah.
The whole shop can self-organize. Mm. And so yeah, you can try stuff and you can decide that things aren't working and you can throw this out and bring this in, and it's easy, right? Because it's all so small and you're more or less in charge. As soon as you get into 3,000 people, it's a different ballgame. Mm. And even 300 is a different ballgame. And yeah. I worked with a company a couple of years ago now that they probably had 150, 200 programmers. I'm just guessing here. They were in a good sized building and they filled up two floors of the building, so it's probably more than that. But they had a tyrant in charge. They had the least competent agile consultant I've ever come across. She came in and she was going to put Scrum in place, and she was a jackbooted thug. People were scared of her, and she forced them to do what she wanted them to do. And if any, they were, I came in as an agile consultant. I'm saying, let's try this. And people were afraid to try stuff. Because, no, if I try stuff, she's going to come down on me, or that's not the right way to do things. Yeah. And that company is just screwed. And she was getting paid almost $1 million a year as a consultant for doing this, which drove me nuts since I wasn't getting paid anything like that. But she knew the right people. She was a friend of the CTO, but she was doing a huge amount of damage. One person doing a huge amount of damage. And it was because that control focused thing was something that upper management was willing to play along with. And the company was big enough that they couldn't do the sort of, you know, interaction among friends that we're talking about when we're talking about a group with 30 people in it.
Yeah.
Right. And all of a sudden processes have to come in place, and all of a sudden there's documented stuff, and all of a sudden there's, I have to get permission, and I can't make this change until I run it by the architects, and just all this other stuff that just doesn't exist in a company that has 30 people in it. So a small company is easy. I've never had any problems making smaller companies agile, helping them be agile. Mm. It's the big ones. And it's because of cultural pushback. It's because the culture of the organization just won't accept it.
Look at the corporate antibody.
Yeah,
that's a big part of it. And the whole incentive system, you're incented to not do it.
Yeah.
Right? And there's just a lot of forces that are fighting against any real change.
Yeah, so I guess I can see where you're coming from now, that I haven't had any of those huge scale, terrible experiences where you really, like Fowler talks about semantic diffusion that's happened with Agile. I think it sounds like you've seen that in the flesh in very bad ways. And I think that would be jarring, right? You know what I mean? And make you want to see things done a better way. And so, I see where you're coming from. Yeah.
It's jarring. It's also frustrating, right? Is that these guys they had like a million lines of Perl, which is sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah.
And it was really holding them back, the Perl was. And they were terrified of the code. They were afraid to touch anything. Their development environment was Vim. Is that they didn't even have a visual debugger. They were using an old Unix-style command line debugger. And changes that should have taken an hour or two were taking weeks. And I think about the agility of the organization, the low-hanging fruit, there's just so much low-hanging fruit there. Put in a decent, don't even change the language, right? Just bring in Eclipse and put a Perl plug-in into it and work through that instead of you working the way you're doing. And they wouldn't even do that. They were afraid to do that. And they came up with lots of excuses for not being able to do that.
Yeah.
And it was really preventative, as they were their own worst enemies here. Mm-hmm. And it's speaking as somebody who is, you know, I probably care too much about these companies that I work for because I really want them to succeed. So I get very frustrated when there's all this low-hanging fruit that they could do that would help a lot, and they won't do it for one reason or another.
Do you have any advice for anybody trying to influence people, more people than Dunbar's number?
Well, you know, in this company, there was one group that was succeeding at being much more agile than the rest of the company. Mm-hmm. And they literally walled themselves off. They found an office way off in a corner of the building that you had to like go down a set of steps and up another set of steps and then onto a secret elevator and up the elevator to their little corner hole.
Secret wall. I love it.
they built a wall of partitions of whiteboards and stuff around it, and they wouldn't let managers in.
Yeah.
And they said, so we're going to be agile here inside these walls. We're going to be agile.
Wow.
And they pulled it off. And they wouldn't let anybody in. It's that they didn't even want to let me in, which was kind of, you know, I thought, I'm here to help, right? If I can help you. And they said, oh, no. You were hired by management, so you're not invited. That was fine, right? By the end of the gig, they did want me to come in, but unfortunately, there wasn't any time left at that point. But the point was is that they managed to basically build a little Skunkworks project inside the organization by physically separating themselves from the rest of the organization and doing things properly inside that organization. And people did notice is that you look at the management who was doing its worst to get the rest of the organization to work in the worst possible way. And they didn't know what those guys up in the corner were doing, but they sure weren't going to mess with it because they were doing more work and better quality work than anybody else in the organization. Mm-hmm. So basically they were left alone. And the only problem with that is there was no way for them to diffuse out. Mm-hmm. As they had pulled about four smaller, what were scrum teams at the time, into them. So there was this little four group, but because they had built this wall around themselves, none of it was diffusing out into the rest of the organization. And in order to get things to diffuse out, what they had to do is get rid of this tyrant who was in charge of everything else. And they weren't willing to do that for political reasons. So there we were. But I think in a less screwed up company, that would have worked. Because they would have been sitting up there in their corner doing things right, and people would have paid attention. And eventually, somebody up the hierarchy would have said, whatever they're doing, I want everybody to be doing that because they're doing such a good job. Yeah. And eventually, it would have come out. It'll take a while. It'll take much longer for things to diffuse out that way than it would having somebody on top saying, okay, we're just going to do this, guys. And if you don't like it, leave. But the trade-off is time, really, right? Are you going to do this in a year, or are you going to do this in 7 years or 8 years?
Yeah. So it's like a little bit more of a grassroots thing, but sometimes it's really hard in an organization like that to actually found that grassroots movement. But once it's established, then for a while it can influence over time just through performance alone, and disprove the prevailing, golden theory, right?
It's hard to argue with success.
Yeah. Right? And so in that micro organization, did they have a particularly understanding leader, or how did?
Several of them. And not only that, though, but they were also being agile, which means that everybody understood.
Yeah.
It was just one guy who understood ordering people around, just they all got it.
Yeah.
But more to the point, they had a leader who was willing to really do the buffer my team from the rest of the organization thing.
Yeah.
He saw it as his job to build this wall around the team and not let anybody in.
I've seen that pattern multiple times now.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. I feel like any strong transformation story where something really innovative did happen, it usually starts with something like that. Someone builds, in this case, physical walls and protects a system to really do what's best and not be constrained. Then real change in effectiveness can happen. But
can happen,
yeah.
Doesn't always happen. Sometimes what happens is that they're successful and then the bigger organization says, we're going to pull those guys back in.
Yeah.
And they destroy the functional team and everything goes to hell. Yeah. Right? Sun did that with JavaSoft years ago. Right? JavaSoft was an amazingly functional, small organization that was doing great work. And Sun decided, well, you guys can't be a company anymore. We're going to pull you back into Sun, and they wrecked it. Java, that was the beginning of the decline of Java when they pulled JavaSoft into SunSoft.
Interesting. And,
it can go both ways.
Yeah. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I'm sure we can keep going and hit all sorts of more controversial topics and have more fun. But we're starting to hit our time box. So before we close, is there anything you'd like to share or plug?
If I can help you get in touch, right? Is that the if you go holub.com/chat and you can set up a video call and I can discuss problems that you're having. I'm working on an agile videos class right now that was a project that started a couple of years ago with a Kickstarter project and it got completely stalled. And it's been unstalled for the last week or so. So I don't know how long it's going to take for us to get the show live, but I'm expecting that to actually be up and functional probably by mid-September. So that's at agilitry with a T-R-Y.com. I'll send you the URL. But there's not much before mid-September. There won't be much there unless you want to see what exists right now, which is about 20% of the total material, but the rest of it should be done by then. And so that'll be an easy way to sort of listen to me go on and on and on for hours about various kinds of agile things that I find interesting. I won't be talking about any particular process, because if you haven't figured that out, I'm not big on canned processes, but general agility. So those are two big things. I owe O'Reilly a couple of book proposals. So there's probably going to be an O'Reilly book eventually, but that's far enough in the future that it's not really something to plug yet, but keep your eyes peeled at least. But, go on to my website, holub.com, sign up for the mailing list. I mail things out about 4 times a year. So you won't get any spam on it, I promise. And I can keep people in touch. And get hold of me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter a lot. I'm at Alan Holub on Twitter. And I'm happy to talk to you on Twitter.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I and other guests on the show and other people we work with have gotten a lot of value from following you on Twitter. So I would recommend it. So I guess with that, please like and subscribe. Please, we're open to your feedback. We're open to being, we're trying to be not agile. We're trying to have agility in the show. So we would love to have your feedback and adjust and ways to make hit topics or guests or anything you would like to see. So please reach out to us on Twitter, YouTube, etc. Until next time, have a good one, and we'll see you later.
Bye, everybody.